think it's really important to especially note, you know, we ask clients, do you have a disabled child? And they automatically think a profoundly disabled child from birth or something like that. But very often a disabled child for, say, an 80-year-old client of mine looks like a 60-year-old adult who got injured working and is now on Social Security disability for their income because they became disabled on the job. And they might still be mentally fully competent and able to do things, but they are receiving this government benefit. So that term can be so, so broad. And that Social Security disability, when you're talking about someone who's young versus someone who's old and has worked in the system, it's a different process.
Welcome to Financially Ever After Widowhood, the podcast where we empower women to take control of their financial future after the loss of a spouse. I'm your host, Stacey Francis, president and CEO of Francis Financial, an award-winning and nationally recognized financial advisory firm. With the help of incredible guests, I'm ready to guide you through this challenging transition.
Our special guest today has been listed as a 2022 best lawyer, ranking in both elder law and trust and estate. Britt Berner racks up many awards, including the Brooklyn Star Under 40, Outstanding Women and Law, and even received the Caregiver's Champion by Caring Kind. She doesn't let grass grow under her feet, and she gives back to her community. She's the immediate past chair of the New York City Bar Association on the legal problems of aging. And she's the chair-elect of the Elder Law and Special Needs Planning of the New York State Bar Association. She's had many different leadership roles and gives back not only to her field, but to others. She's a charter member of the Advisory Council for the CATS Institute for Women's Health at Northwell. She contributes to the institution's mission of enhancing women's health through education, prevention, wellness programs, and clinical care. And today, Britt and I are having a fantastic, interesting conversation about the things you need to know about if you have a disabled child or adult child. We also talk about the issues that spouses face when their loved one has been diagnosed with a life-limiting or terminal illness. Britt gives the A's, the B's, and the C's, and well, actually, I will tell you, she goes out to Z to talk to you about all the things you need to plan for to not only take care of your loved ones, to make sure that they get the benefits they need for their medical care and income, but also to take care of yourself. So without further ado, please help me welcome our very important guest today, Britt Berner. Britt, it's so nice to have you here. And we're talking about some pretty big topics, special needs planning and elder law. And I feel like if we could almost do a podcast really on both, but I know that these are both two topics that are really close to your heart and an expertise that you bring to your clients. So I'm excited to have this conversation with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited too. It's really nice to talk about these things and put them out there. And it makes people a little uncomfortable sometimes, but it's real things that are affecting a lot of people these days. And I think it used to get swept under the rug, the idea of somebody with special needs, and really want people to be planning properly when they do have a loved one or concerned about their own special needs.
And that's actually a question. I mean, for me, when I think about special needs, I immediately think about children. I go to that place where it's a child. Are there also special needs essentially later in life? And how would the planning be different for, let's say, a child under age 18 who's not an adult, and special needs for, let's say, either an adult child or even for your spouse who has been diagnosed with a life-limiting illness or a terminal illness?
Sure. When I think about special needs, supplemental needs, what I'm really thinking about is anyone in need of government benefits. So what are those government benefits, right? Okay. So it could be medical, like Medicaid, to help pay for the costs of care or be health insurance, primary health insurance. It could also be people who need SSI because they are supplemental security income because they are not able to have their own income. It could be SSDI, so disability income. And so depending on the type of needs and the type of government benefits someone is looking for, that's how we determine the type of planning. And for younger people, we're very often worried about, okay, well, some people get their schooling up to age 21 or maybe 26 with some of these different programs. And then when we get into older life, a loss of capacity or a heightened need for medical care in someone's later years, we're talking about long-term care, either in a facility or at home. And sometimes we're talking about it through the Medicaid program, which is a government program. And sometimes we're talking about it in terms of planning for that time with maybe private long-term care insurance or self-funding. There's a lot of different topics that go into this idea of planning for someone's additional or special needs.
When we're thinking about a child, so age 18 and below, to qualify for Medicaid or SSI or SSDI, what does that look like? Do you qualify for all three? I mean, I know Medicaid is more on the healthcare play, you know, healthcare covering healthcare costs and needs. If you are approved for Medicaid, does that mean that you're also potentially approved for the other two benefits of SSI or SSDI?
So they have different standards. So one doesn't automatically mean the other. When somebody is approved for Social Security disability, after a two-year retroactive period, they can get Medicare. However, a lot of people don't get SSDI because the standards for how you can qualify aren't just this person is disabled. Yes, you have to be deemed disabled by the Social Security Administration, but there's also, depending on your asset level in terms of or the age at which you were disabled, if you worked any quarters, and it gets complicated. So it's not just a straight disability determination that gets you that benefit. So it's going to be different depending on the age and certainly the work history, if any, of that disabled person. I think it's really important to especially note, you know, we ask clients, do you have a disabled child? And they automatically think a profoundly disabled child from birth or something like that. But very often, a disabled child for, say, an 80-year-old client of mine looks like a 60-year-old adult who got injured working and is now on Social Security disability for their income because they became disabled on the job. And they might still be mentally fully competent and able to do things, but they are receiving this government benefit. So that term can be so broad, and that Social Security disability, when you're talking about someone who's young versus someone who's old and has worked in the system, it's a different process.
What are the criteria of someone that, instead of applying for Social Security disability insurance and getting that, is SSI? How do those two differ?
Sure. So someone who is not deemed disabled by Social Security can't qualify for SSDI. Is someone who is just in need of income. And that person has to have less than $2,000 in assets. So that means your bank balance has to be under $2,000. And then you don't have other sources of income. And then depending on your other sources of income, it could reduce your SSI benefit until it's gone. But you're talking about, depending on where you are, you're talking about less than $1,000 a month in income. So it's not a huge benefit. And certainly depending on where you are in the country and what the cost of living is, it might not cover too much. So when we're talking about straight SSI for income purposes, that's what we're talking about.
And so what I'm hearing is SSI, Social Security income, and also Medicaid, they are really based on your asset level, how much income is coming in. Medicaid being the resource that can help give you coverage for medical care. And SSI, Social Security income, being that additional boost to your income. And like you said, I mean, this is not an exciting a dollar amount, maybe $1,000 a month, but something that helps. And, you know, on the other side of Social Security disability, that is more so tied to being able to show your disability, unable to work, unable to perform. Does that sound right, Britt?
Yeah, correct. And Social Security disability is either tied to your own work record. So for example, if you've put in 40 quarters, you have the ability to apply on your own work record. But for those who were deemed disabled at a young age, they might be able to qualify on a retired or deceased parent's work record. So as you can see, the rules get pretty nuanced, especially if you have someone who has more of that born with or came into at a young age, a disability and inability to work. And then, as you say, that is income for food and shelter when we're talking about SSI. That's the intention of what it pays for. And then Medicaid, like Medicare, is health insurance. So a lot of times people think that Medicaid is going to give them all these additional benefits. And what they sometimes don't realize is, for example, here in New York City, HRA will provide your Medicaid very often. And that might also be where you apply for SNAP benefits, what we used to call food stamps back in prior years. And you might get them at the same place. You might get a Metro card for travel at the same place, but it's actually just the agency providing it, but it's a different program. And they don't necessarily have the same rules for qualification. So a lot of people tie it to the same agency, but really it's not that the local Department of Social Services, but they are actually different programs with different reasons or different ways to qualify.
There's a lot of complexity here. Who are the people to help someone who's listening to navigate this, to understand, based on my situation, what am I eligible for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you'll notice a lot of what I'm saying are very broad, generalized statements. I'm being careful not to be too specific because somebody who's listening, who's in one county or one state versus another, it could be very different information. And so I'm trying to give the overall information without giving that specialized advice. So finding an attorney in your area, or if possible, if there's a social services agency that gives case management, which some people have through some of the services they already have, that's the best place to start to figure out what you're eligible for. There is a law website for attorneys called NAELA, N-A-E-L-A. The website is NAELA.org, and it is the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. You can actually go on that website, you can type in your zip code, and it will give you attorneys in your area who are part of NAELA. Now, obviously, I can't vouch for every attorney on the NAELA website, but I can tell you that someone who has enrolled in NAELA and is a dues-paying member of NAELA has made it their business for this to be a large part of their practice. And so it's a good place to start. Obviously, you have to vet them yourself. But I think that that's really important to get
a great resource.
Advice as you can. Yeah, it really is.
And because I will tell you that navigating this on your own, I can't even imagine how hard that must be. And I've had very little exposure. I helped one of my friends fill out the application for SSDI, so Social Security Disability Income. Britt, the application was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
And here I am, I'm filling it out. I'm not the one with the disability. I'm doing it for her. I'm like, I don't know how she would ever in a million years do this. I'm a financial professional. I'm very well educated. And it was so hard for me. You know, if we were able to have reached out to an attorney to just guide us, help us through that process, a really big difference. And I was just reading of how many adults are disabled. As of 2022, 13.5% of the US population have some type of disability. That number skyrockets to 46% for individuals who are 75 and older. These are very large populations. And as our population lives longer, we're going to be living our older years with more likely a disability. So when we're thinking about that, Britt, if you have, let's say, a spouse that has been diagnosed, or yourself, you've been diagnosed with a life-limiting or a terminal illness, and you're starting to not be able to function and need help, what are the options for someone who does not have long-term care insurance and potentially doesn't have significant assets to fund it. And we can talk about those other two next, but someone who can't afford that $10,000 a month for someone either to come into their home to give them round-the-clock care or being able to go to a nursing home or another type of situation.
Yeah, certainly. So this is where it's going to get very specific based on where you live. So
got it.
I'm here in New York. New York has, I always say to people, we pay taxes and we pay nice size taxes. So we have a fairly strong budget when it comes to Medicaid. So Medicaid mm-hmm. is a federal program with federal money, state money, and it's administered by the county. So when I talk about local advice, I'm talking about localized down to your county, because even some of the rules are interpreted differently by different counties. So here in New York, there's a lot of opportunity for those bills to be paid. So let me just give you an example. Someone who comes to me and they say, my loved one is in a nursing home and we don't know what to do. We can't afford it. Now, here in Manhattan and out on Long Island, and it obviously gets a little less expensive as you get further out from the city, but not very much. You could be looking at a private pay bill of about $20,000 a month for a nursing home. It's a nursing home where you might be sharing your room with one, two, maybe three other people. So this is incredibly high cost. Essentially, anyone that I come across who ends up in a facility, they usually can't afford it on any kind of long-term basis because it's incredibly expensive. In New York, there's protections for spouses, so a spouse doesn't become impoverished if their spouse is in a facility, and that is part of our Medicaid program. There's also an ability for an individual who's in the nursing home to keep a higher threshold of assets than outside of than other states. So for example, here in New York, someone who goes on Medicaid can have just over $30,000 in assets this year, 2023. However, in other states, it's at that $2,000 SSI level. So it's going to be very different based on where you are. And then the techniques to try and save the family home or whatever little bit we can save for the spouse or dependent or maybe not dependent family members is going to be different. This is actually where the question, why we often ask if somebody has a disabled child, not just because when we're planning their estate, we want to make sure we're protecting the individual, the child, but we also want to make sure that if there is a disabled child, a lot of times there are certain assets we can transfer to a disabled child that we couldn't otherwise transfer to different family members. And there's a lot of planning opportunity. So understanding, and I think this is probably, if we talk about the difference between elder law, which is really just estate planning and looking at these other issues, and traditional estate planning is we're really looking at the individual, we're looking at their family, we're looking at who they're naming as beneficiaries, and we're taking all the things we know from traditional trust and estates planning and all the things we know about planning around government benefits and long-term care needs, and we're putting it into one plan. And that's really what I think elder law does very differently from a traditional trust and estates planning.
Really glad you brought that up because, Britt, that's one of the questions I had on my mind of, like, what's the difference between just plain vanilla trust and estate, which there's no plain vanilla trust and estate. Mm-hmm. I know you know that, and elder law. And what I think is also interesting, the number of attorneys who are able to actually practice elder law and have made that their specialty is actually not very many. There's gazillions of trust and estate attorneys out there. But when you go to look for someone who has that specific focus in the elder law area, it's much harder to find those people. Why is that, Britt? Is it because it's such a, at least in my mind, the very complicated, very nuanced, the stakes are very high type of law? Is that what that is? Or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. I never thought necessarily about why, but I could probably make two guesses. One is because traditionally assisting people who are seeking out government benefits might be less lucrative of a practice in some ways than someone who you're doing heavy tax planning for, where there's a lot of assets at stake in terms of paying taxes upon an estate, you know, estate tax planning. And then I think the other reason is you can't dabble in elder law. Now, I don't think you should dabble in any area of the law, but with elder law, it's changing almost daily, right? COVID came in and that put us in a public health emergency. Well, a public health emergency greatly impacts, for better and for worse, the medical system. So now we have a government-funded, federal and state government-funded health insurance system, which is now under all of these COVID rules and COVID easements. And then we have the unwind of the COVID easements. And everything is based upon the budgets on an annual basis of the state. So you're constantly watching what's going on up at your state capital, whatever your state is, what changes are coming down the pike, where are they limiting the program, where are they expanding it, where does that give us planning opportunities? And so if you're not doing it every day, and if you're not watching it constantly, it could be very easy to get left behind, because it is an area of the law that changes so frequently, not just by rulemaking and lawmaking, but also by regulation, which the Department of Health can put out a regulation today, and it changes how we look at things tomorrow. So it's quick moving sometimes.
I can imagine, and it's a lot to stay on top of, you know, very much. For someone who's listening and two different scenarios, let's say first scenario, she has a adult child who is disabled. When she passes, she wants to make sure that she passes that wealth to him or her in a way that doesn't disqualify them from all the benefits that are based on having a small amount of assets, whether that's Medicaid or that Social Security income. What are the things that she needs to be thinking about in how she leaves assets to that child?
Yes. So the greatest tool in that regard is the Supplemental Needs Trust. If mom leaves assets and her documents say that it goes into a properly drafted Supplemental Needs Trust for her child, that's what we call a third-party Supplemental Needs Trust. That's money that came from mom, went directly into a trust, and mom has to be thinking about who's going to be the trustee of that trust. So those assets will be fully protected from government benefits, and therefore they won't count as an asset when assets are being counted for various benefits. And those assets can be used for the benefit of mom's child. But who's going to be in charge? And this is the hardest part, right? So sometimes there's a really great sibling who's like, I'll step up, I'll do it, I'll be the trustee. But a lot of times, because of there isn't a sibling, or because of family dynamics or something else going on, that's not possible. So we have to look sometimes to professional or corporate trustees. And that is the hardest decision. I'd say for young people who are doing regular estate planning, the hardest decision is if something happens to both parents, where's the child go, right?
Yeah, and exactly. Then, who's the guardian?
It cripples people. They don't want to sign anything, right? It's the same with people with older adult disabled children is,
right,
I can't figure out who to make trustee. And then they get paralyzed from doing anything. And that's the worst thing you can do. Because if upon mom's death, this money vests in the child and this child becomes the owner, then the only option varies on age, et cetera. But then the only option is to create what we call a first party supplemental needs trust. And in that case, there's a payback to Medicaid at the child's death. And so there's less of a protection available.
Yeah.
And so the best way to do it is to have the assets go directly from mom's estate to child in a trust with a well-meaning trustee, and with the flexibility for a trustee to be changed if there's a problem with the trustee. Either they no longer want to act, they can't act, there's a successor, or a mechanism for appointing a successor in place.
And can you go over again why you would have a first person trust? Is that because you can't find a trustee that is a family member? Or when does that third party trust not be able to happen? Can you explain that again?
Yes. Yeah, so in order for it to be a third party, with no payback, and therefore it goes to whomever mom says after the disabled child passes, it needs to go directly in mom's documents. It needs to create the trust for the child and feed directly in.
Okay. So immediate transfer.
Correct. Yep. If the proper planning isn't done and mom's estate just goes to the child and now it's the child's money and there's a scramble to keep or to probably go off of and then back onto government benefits because now they've been disqualified. If I'm the disabled child, my assets can only go into a first party with a payback. So more opportunity to protect when the protection's coming from the higher generation. There's less opportunity for me to protect my own assets once they've come to me.
Yeah. So what you're really talking about is making sure that there's planning in advance. So if someone's listening here, there's no question that doing that planning of going, setting up that trust, the special needs trust now in your will is the best thing you can do. Otherwise, if you're leaving that money outside directly to your child, you're number one, going to disqualify them from the benefits of Medicaid and SSI. But you're going to have to put it in a first party trust, which they'll then have to pay back Medicaid and pay back those benefits when they die. And then it will take them some time to requalify to receive Medicaid and SSI. So I'm hearing that like that planning is just really important, very important.
Yeah. And depending on the type of disability, again, we have people with physical disabilities and people with cognitive disabilities.
Yeah.
But also depending on the type of disability, your child might not be able to or may not have the tools that they need to embark upon the process of protecting themselves. And that can be very scary too. So, you know, and I alluded to this earlier, I think there used to be this concept of sweeping under the rug, this idea of having a disabled child. There was a stigma and people didn't want to talk about it. And what we really try to encourage is being very aware of what are mom's needs, sure, but what's mom worried about? Mom's worried about what's going to happen when I pass away and my child, who I'm everything to in the world, is in this world alone. How do you set that child, be it a young child or adult child, how do you set them up for success? And if there's government benefits involved, the supplemental needs trust is the key to getting that.
Yeah, 100%. Accomplished. Right. So the other scenario I want to go over, because I know we're coming up to time, but the other scenario is she has just visited the doctors, found out that her spouse has terminal cancer and expected to live another 1 to 2 years and have assets that are significant, but would love to potentially take advantage of Medicaid or some other types of benefits. Are there options for her to make sure that the assets that are joint assets can be protected from having to be spent down for all of that care and potentially being able to qualify for Medicaid?
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's the typical lawyer answer, right?
Maybe. And it's a big maybe because I know that there are a lot of rules about essentially whether, you know, I've seen people talk about medical divorce, right? And the government is pretty smart about that of like, you're cohabitating, medical divorce, and your spouse just was diagnosed. So I know that there's a lot of maybes, but I think that what's interesting is the fact that even you said maybe, right? So that like
exactly.
Based on your situation, reaching out to an elder law attorney to really understand what options you do have and what time frame, in which time frame would you have them?
Definitely. Like I said, it goes down to what county you live in, right? So I primarily practice, or not primarily because it's two, between Suffolk County on Long Island and here in Manhattan. Those are the two places that I am most often. And my answer to a spouse that you just described would be different in those two places. And so just to show you, I'm splitting my brain sometimes, especially with Zoom these days. I'm like, where do you live again? As I'm on the Zoom to figure out what to tell them. But there are options. Certain states, New York is one of them, has something called spousal refusal. So you want to get educated to, does your state have spousal refusal? And what does that look like? In some states that have spousal refusal, then based on the county, they might still ask the spouse, who is a legally responsible relative, for some contribution towards care. And in some counties, they might not. And so knowing that's why you really have to drill down and get that advice. And how you structure the assets, the family structure matters, right? So I would go as far as to say, okay, well, do mom and dad in that case, Are they a mom and dad? Do they have children? If they have children, what's the relationship like with them and their children, between the children? Do they trust their children to be trustee of perhaps a trust that can protect some of the assets? We really have to get very detailed on what level of comfort they have in terms of the things that we can do, because we have a lot of tools in our toolbox, right? Just like you as an advisor have, there's a lot of ways you can save, right? But the question is, what's going to work best for them? So the answer, again, is maybe, and there might be something we can do. It's just, are you willing to take the steps necessary and maybe give up some control on certain assets in order to achieve what you're looking to? And does it get you there? And we're running numbers. I'll tell you, I had a client once who was in the case that you said. Her husband had an illness. It was unclear how long he was going to live for, but he was going to get sicker. And it was clear that at some point he would die of this. And when she first came to me, she was in a location where they do ask the spouse for contribution. And we ran the numbers and we realized that what they were likely to ask her for, she'd be better off paying out of pocket. We just ran straight numbers, right? We figured out what we could do, and that was the decision. But she came back a year later, and based on a change in circumstances of the assets and the income, also his level of need was now high enough that she was better off applying and contributing through the program. And so it's not always an answer that I would give someone once, and then I'd say, don't look into it again. I might say, call me back in 3 months. Call me back in 6 months. Let's watch the situation. So it's fluid.
In spousal refusal, that might be a new term for a lot of people. My understanding is that it's just one spouse is refusing to pay for the medical care of the other spouse and putting that kind of burden on the state program to be
Correct.
Able to do that. Is that what you're talking about with the
yes
but
exactly.
What I'm also hearing is that not all states allow that some states or counties require some contribution from a spouse. So again, making sure that you understand what the rules are and the laws are in your area.
And I just want to add also that spousal refusal, we're also talking about, is legally responsible relative refusal is really what it is. And I tell people all the time, you may feel morally or ethically obligated to your parents. I certainly do, but that's not a legal responsibility to pay for the cost of someone's care. So a spouse is a legally responsible relative, and the parents of a minor child are legally responsible relatives. But other family members, again, they might have another responsibility to a higher power, but certainly it is not a legal financial responsibility.
It's interesting. And that's actually so important for many of us who find ourselves in the sandwich generation where we're, you know, caring for children and raising children. And then you have parents that we're helping also financially. And what you're sharing is that that's good that you're doing that if you want to do that, but you're not legally responsible for that. But caring for your child, you are legally responsible, potentially also caring for your spouse. That would also be something where you could potentially find yourself in that legally responsible.
Correct.
But yeah, I can see no hospital is going to come after you because your mom or your dad hasn't paid their bill. We've gone through so much. Any last minute thoughts or suggestions that you want to make sure that we get to? And then I also want to make sure that our listeners can get your information so they can reach out to you.
Yes, definitely. I think the main thing I want people to leave with today is the concept which you've talked about a few times, which is getting personalized advice. But the second thing I want to say is you don't have to be old to do elder law planning. And I think people always say, you know, oh, elder law, I'm not in my 80s. And I want to broaden people's concepts, right? So I would say that I did elder law planning in my 30s. Why? Because I did a robust power of attorney, where if I became disabled or I had any issue where I need somebody to financially handle my affairs, I have that power of attorney in place. It's in a safe place. No one's acting right now, but it's there. I have a healthcare proxy. If I became unable to make my own medical decisions, somebody's in place to do that. And maybe I haven't gone as far as to, you know, put my assets in an irrevocable trust or the more complicated plans that we would do as somebody got older. but there is definitely planning and a thought about your own disability that I think people should be having at a very young age. And so I don't want people to get scared away by the term elder law. It's just responsible planning for not just your death, but also a potential disability.
Right. I don't think you could have ended this podcast any better. That is so important because that is such a myth. Even myself, like, I'm too old for elder law planning. Well, not the case, right? Not the case. Yep. So how do our listeners get a hold of you? You know, maybe share the best email and website. If they have questions, if they want to work with you to be able to start to put their planning in place.
Yeah, thanks for asking, because I love to talk about our website. We have a great website, and the best part about it is it's full of information. So burnerlaw.com is our website, and you can see webinars that I've done on various topics to elder law that relate to traditional trust and estates planning. We have a blog section that's a pretty robust section of articles that you can sort by topic to learn more about a specific issue that we're talking about today. And then you can get the contact information for our firm. So our website is a great piece of information if you're doing some initial research. And then my email is pretty simply bburner@burnerlaw.com. And I'm happy to talk to people and just see what's going on. I am licensed to practice only in New York State, but again, that NALA.org is a great option if you're looking for an attorney that does what I do, but in a different location.
And I will just, again, you know, underscore, I'm on the website right now, and under the elder law and the special needs area, you have this beautiful listed out frequently asked questions, like how is elder law different than just general estate planning? Who would need an elder law attorney? How do you prepare before you sit down with an elder law attorney? All these different pieces that I think are really helpful, as well as special needs. So definitely go to that website, burnerlaw.com. And for all of you listening today, we'll make sure that we put all of these resources in the show notes, including NALA, so that you have that as a website, as a resource. We'll do have links also to information on Medicaid, as well as SSI and SSDI. Britt, I can't thank you enough for being here, for sharing so much about a really important topic that I have to say, I feel like is not really talked about as much as it really should be.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I like being the ambassador for elder law and getting out there and explaining to people why it's not necessarily what people thought it was. And we're so happy to have partners like you and your firm, because if an attorney is not working with someone's financial team, it can be such a disjointed plan, right? We really want good, solid plans for people. So thank you. And thanks for doing this podcast. It's a great service.
Thank you. We went through a lot of pieces, and I think the biggest summary that you can take away that Britt Burner mentioned as well is to reach out to an elder law attorney in your state to understand your unique issues and what's available, what support is available for you and your family. And again, please visit the show notes. We have the link for NALA.org in those show notes that you can find that person to help you through this process. For so many couples and families, when facing a illness or a disability, well, finances are the number one concern. And if you have any questions, please reach out to me at Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, at francisfinancial.com. The best part of my job is meeting with people like you, helping, answering questions, and being there to know that someone cares and that giving a helping hand. Please reach out to us and visit our website at www.francisfinancial.com. You can go right to the contact page and click a link to set up a time for us to meet in a quick half-hour conversation, hopefully again giving you the tools that you need and the support that you deserve. Thank you for joining us for Financially Ever After.
Thank you for tuning in to Financially Ever After Widowhood. If there's a question you'd love for us to answer on the podcast, we can do that for you. All you have to do is give us a call, and the number is 347-682-5580. Let me say that again, 347-682-5580. Whether you're working with an advisor or you're maybe doing it on your own, we invite you to reach out to us at www.francisfinancial.com, or you can email me at Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, at francisfinancial.com. Our hope is to be a resource for you to help you also find a great financial advisor, whether that be with our firm or one of our trusted colleagues. Please be sure to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast, and join us next time on Financially Ever After Widowhood.